Welcome to the War Room with Mike Blanco. Prepare yourself to get dropped into a new subject each week as a soldier's diligence meets entrepreneurial challenges in today's marketplace. So sit back and enjoy the tactics of the War Room with Michael Blanco. Here's your host.
Thanks for tuning in to the War Room podcast. I'm your host, Mike Blanco. I really appreciate you guys tuning in for part two of our conversation with Sergeant First Class Rob Carpenter and Dr. Nathaniel Chapman, where we're going to dig deeper into Rob's journey of military transition, entrepreneurship, with a focus on his battle with PTSD and suicide attempts. Rob, Doc, I really appreciate you guys coming back on the show.
And I have to do one disclaimer. So since I'm on here and I am a clinical psychologist, I want it to be known that this, even as I'm talking to Rob, this is not a client therapy thing. And any advice that people gather from here is not coming from the standpoint of therapy. Just have to say that.
Now, you were successful upon transitioning because you became a cop. You had a plan when you left, but you still struggled, right? So tell me about your transition. You went from being a rock star soldier to a civilian, and you took a lot of, and all of us, I don't care if you've deployed or didn't deploy, we all take a little bit of baggage away from the military, right? So tell us about your battle with PTSD and all that jazz. So you had to teach you talked to me before about how you had to teach yourself to be a civilian again. You struggled with taking the uniform off, right? So, and Dr. Chapman, you probably relate to this with your 6 months and 6 years and 11 months of service. I won't rob you of the 11 months. It's hard taking that uniform off, man, because you wear it so much day in and day out. It's not like an accountant with his suit. It's not like a lawyer with his suit. You know, that uniform represents so much of what you have done, who you are. We wear our awards on our uniform, our airborne badges, our ranger tabs. Like, we wear who we are. Literally, we wear it on our sleeve. So when it's time to transition and we take that off, like, let's be real. Like if we're not well equipped to cope with it, we kind of lose who we are. Like, did you struggle with that, Rob?
Yeah, I absolutely did struggle with it. I remember very vividly, you know, the day that I exited, I got my bulldog stamp and exit. I was so quick to unblouse my boots. and I mean, I think that looking back on that brief moment of me exiting a military post and just knowing that I had my whole life ahead of me, looking back on it now, I mean, it was probably one of the most honorable things that I've ever done. And I didn't really look at it that way as I was leaving. So, you know, another thing that stented into my PTSD and my mental health is going back to what Mike said before, never really taking off the uniform. And that's a major part of veteran mental health and getting to a point where you're accepting your purpose as a civilian. But transitioning from military to civilian, I've never once heard anyone tell a successful, completely successful story about it. Leaving Georgia, where I was stationed with the 164 armor, and moving back to my hometown in Northeast Pennsylvania, basically running with the same crowd that I did prior to, you know, joining the military, getting right back into the things that I once had wanted to get away from. So, you know, I would say that contributed a lot to the start of my mental health decline. But, you know, never really taking off the uniform is a major struggle with all veterans, not just myself. I've spoken to many different veterans groups about this, and I think that it's a problem because not taking anything away from the way that the military operates, but they don't really set you up for success leaving the military. The brief transition that you go through, they're allowing you to use your skills, but they're not telling you how hard or difficult it's going to be to put those skills in effect. Me knowing that I wanted to be a police officer when I left the military, it helped me tremendously. When I did end up going home and getting back into my education and you know, putting on a different uniform. But it never really helped me take the other uniform off. I basically just, you know, took off one uniform and put another one on, and I never really left the other one behind, if that makes any sense. So it was difficult for me, you know, getting back into a crowd that I once wanted to leave, drinking with my buddies and acting like a college frat boy. It was difficult because I went from, you know, waking up at 05 in the morning and doing PT to, you know, going to bed at 05 after a long night of drinking. You know, there's no timelines in the civilian world. So you're basically waking up like, oh, I don't have a schedule today. And as once you had a schedule, I mean, your whole day is planned out in the military. You got PT, you got first formation, you got, you know, there's lots of adapting to that schedule. So I won't take anything away from that, like we discussed earlier. But for the most part, you know what your day is going to consist of. That's not the case in the civilian world. I mean, there's a lot of adapting in countries. And for me, I think that was the hardest part because I'm a very organized person. I'm a very, you know, timeline person. I have a planner. And you know, some people make fun of me, but I will walk into a restaurant with a agenda book. And you know, it helps me because I am very organized, and I think that's part of my success, is that knowing what I need to do and getting all these things done. There's not a lot of people out there that do that. So
Doc, why is it, in from a psychological standpoint, why is it that veterans have such a difficult time transitioning? Because people transition all the time. And they seem to do it, well, maybe give or take, depending on the situation. You know, I mean, and I get that it's a drastic transition, but why do veterans struggle so much with transition?
Now, I don't pretend to have the magic answer, but
I'll give you some. I'll put you on the spot.
I think that transitions are difficult for most people. You know, whether it's transitioning from high school to college, or transitioning from single life to marriage, or marriage to baby, or retirement, you know, and for the military veteran, this is either going to be retirement or just leaving a unit. I think there's a lot of things that don't exist in the civilian world that you lose when you take this transition. So you're going from having a culture, right? This culture of people that are like family. You've had a lot of different families throughout your time because you did like tours where you were only there for a couple of years and you moved. But you know, wherever you go, you're going to have these right. people. Some people are lucky enough to go back home. Other people do not. They stay where they're at, and they have to rebuild. Depending on how old they are, that's a whole nother transition. When you're younger, it's easier for you to, you know, connect with people than it is when you get older, depending on, you know, when you're and where you're going. So I think the culture piece is part of it. I think the other thing is you had a purpose. You right. had something that brought meaning to you. And when you're transitioning out, you know, when I transitioned out, it was 14 years ago. And my transition was different than most people because I was in an ROTC unit. So I was kind of already like seemed like in a civilian place. Well, it was still rough because it happened quicker than I thought it was going to happen. And I had to go to Fort Knox to get it. So I wasn't on like a regular base. I had to go to a base, drive 8 hours to get there, come back to kind of get all the debriefing. It happened real quick. And then I was free and I had a major injury. I tore my ACL during that time, had a blood clot. I didn't know how to use the VA system and all those things. Didn't have a job. I had that little scam thing happen. All that happened at once. But the thing is, you're walking away from a culture. You're ending a chapter of your life. For me, it was almost 7 years and from high school to that. So this is like, and this is how it is for most people. They're transitioning, rather transitioning by themselves or with their family. It's a big thing to walk away from culture. It's a big thing to walk away from meaning, particularly when you don't know what you're going to fill it with yet. You might be happy to be free, but you don't know what's next.
Right. It goes back to those kids. And you know, I've had these guys throughout my more than 10 years of experience. They can't wait to get out of the Army. Like, sir, if you just sign this piece of paper, I'll be out in 2 weeks. You got other guys that want to be, you know, spend 20 years, 30 years, be a division sergeant major someday. But you got those guys like, look, I'll be out in 2 weeks. You just stamp my form and I'll be gone. But what's interesting is I always hear back from those guys. Hey, sir, how you doing? You know, I really miss the Army, but more than that, I miss the people. And these are the guys that, you know, their Facebook profile picture will be them deployed or at a range holding a rifle for like the next 5 years. You know what I mean? Because it had such an indelible mark on their life. But one of the things that's for me, and I'm transitioning now, And for me, what I know is going to be so hard is the community and just the tribal nature of the military, because you just don't find that in the rest of society. You know what I mean? What's unique about the military is you can meet a guy for 5 seconds. You can go to school with a dude for 3 weeks, not see him for 5 years, meet up with him when you guys are stationed together. And it's just like, you didn't even skip a beat. You know what I mean? So I think that's really what's unique about the military. And then Rob, so like you struggle through the transition, you struggle taking the uniform off. How did that manifest itself? So you talked about you started drinking, and like a lot of us go back to our hometown where the dudes are still doing exactly what they were doing 10 years ago when you left. And there was a little bit of drug abuse there, right? Like you got into steroids a little bit.
Yeah. So when I left the military, I had a significant image problem. I'm very, Mike will tell you that I am very, you know, into physical fitness. I was a PT stud in the Army. I actually held our battalion high score for PT.
I remember that.
So I was, you know, very conscious of the way that I looked, per se. I didn't like how skinny I was. And so, you know, I got into illegal steroids. I started taking steroids and basically using my time and just, you know, drilling my brain into a gym mentality where I didn't like the way that I looked. I wanted to be bigger. And that ultimately started taking its toll on my mental health as well, knowing that I was consuming illegal substances. And I would say that the booze and the illegal steroids definitely contributed to the declination of my mental health. But you know, just looking back on it, I would say that wanting to be part of a camaraderie that the military offered that I didn't have anymore. You know, when I was fresh out of the military service and I was sitting in a classroom with, you know, fresh college students, 18 years old, and you know, I didn't really feel like I was a part of a group that had my back. As I once, you know, I would show up to work in the military and, you know, it's, hey, Sergeant Carp, hey, right off the bat, you don't have that in the civilian sector of things. I mean, people don't really care what you did with your life. They're just there to help you better yourself for the future. So knowing that I wasn't part of that and, you know, we'll go back to, the news. The news is the worst, you know, social media and the news to me is the worst enemy, because you're seeing soldiers die on TV daily. You're seeing, you know, people that are deployed on your social media pages and the camaraderie that they're sharing. So just go, you miss it. And I mean, ultimately that'll put a strain on anybody's mental health. So.
Right. Like watching the news and seeing, cause I mean, I'm still active duty and that happens to me where I have friends that are deploying to Iraq and Afghanistan and everybody always wonders like, why do veterans in general and even active duty military guys like, man, I just wish I could fucking deploy again. You know what I mean?
You would throw yourself on a plane in a war zone.
Right. In a heartbeat. And this is something our civilian counterparts can't understand. They confuse it with bloodlust and anger and aggression and all these other things. But really what it is, it boils down to is I want to be side by side with my friends and my family. I can't speak for either two of you, but the best sleep I've ever gotten in my life has been while I'm deployed. And when I talk to veterans, that typically is the case. Like I've never slept so good than on some random outpost in the middle of nowhere, Afghanistan or Iraq. And that's because, you know, I'm surrounded by people. I'm surrounded by a community that's working together. And even if I don't like the guy to my left or my right, I might not like him, but nobody else is allowed to not like him. You know what I mean? And we are in this together. And so that's always been really amazing to me. And Doc Chapman, like, what's your take on why, like, if veterans in general, they want to go back. They want to go back. They want to feel that nature. Because I think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, we as people, you know, we tend to remember the good times and not the bad, right? Like when I talk to veterans that have, the longer they've been out, the less they talk about like downloading Connexes and cleaning weapons for hours and hours on end. And the more they talk about the deployments and the camaraderie and their friends and the deployments and the funny stories.
Yeah. You know, I think it's funny that you say that, cause I was just thinking, I was never deployed, but I'm 14 years out. So I think I'm the longest out on this call. I was reading a book, it's called Resilience. It's by a Navy SEAL, and he's basically writing to a comrade of his who's going through some problems right now at the moment, PTSD, other things like that. But he's talking about how when they were deployed, how there was purpose there. There was meaning there. You're getting up every day, you know what you're doing. I mean, it might change. You got to deal with the gray. But you have an idea of what you're doing. You have an idea of who you're doing it with. So there's structure and there's purpose. And I think when you transition out, you lose that.
Right.
And you lose, for all intents and purposes, you lose the uniform. But you haven't, you lose the uniform, but you haven't let the uniform go. But you don't have the uniform anymore. You just holding on to the uniform that is gone. And that's causing a lot of pain.
Right. Right. So Rob, you didn't have this purpose. You weren't really lost because you're still really successful. Right. So like it's a strange dichotomy. It's a dichotomy that I think a lot of veterans walk around with, where on the exterior, they haven't lost a beat. You know, like you look at them, they're in good shape. They're still aggressive. Some of them are highly successful, but when you pull back that curtain, man, like, There's an emptiness there that probably you have a better idea than most and can elaborate. Because you were successful, right? Even as you went into this mental health decline and all these things were going on, which would eventually manifest itself in a suicide attempt too, right? So like talk us through that. Like what, you're a successful entrepreneur, the businesses are going well, you're leaving a restaurant where you just like shook the hands of a bunch of people that work for you, you employ 500 people. So what caused you to say, you know what, today I'm just going to end my life?
So it all goes back to the saying, you never judge a book by its cover. Because even though you may be all sparky and you know, successful on the outside, you never really know what's going on someone's inside. You know, some people have, you know, family issues that, and I make it a point to try to get a feel for all of my employees, you know, mental health on a daily basis. I'll ask them how they're doing, how their family's doing. And I take pride in that because that's what the military taught me to do. They taught me as a leader to always take a vested interest in your soldiers, to know what's going on in their personal lives as well as their military professional lives. So, you know, the transition for me, moving out of the military into the civilian sector, yes, I never really lost a beat in my success rate. I immediately, you know, went into school, finished school, went into the police academy, finished the police academy. On the outside, I was extremely successful. You know, I had friends, I had family that really cared about me, but I was struggling. And, you know, I think part of what initiated my struggle was the survivor's guilt.
So elaborate on that a little bit.
It's like wear and tear. Like if you do a 12-mile ruck march in the military one day, and then 3 days later you do another one, it's just gonna, you know, gradually decline your physical health overall. And that's the same thing with mental health. If you lose one friend, you lose a little bit out of your life. And if you lose another one, it just takes its toll. So knowing that I had lost, you know, many close friends to me in war zones and friends since I exited active duty service.
To include, you know, suicide, right? Like I've lost more soldiers and friends to suicide in my times in the military than I ever did deployed.
Yeah. And you start questioning your sanity. You start questioning why this stuff is happening to people that, you know, we go 12 months on a deployment and come home and act like, you know, we're all good and dandy. And then you start seeing, you know, one by one, you start seeing people decline due to mental health. And God forbid it takes its toll on someone and actually does commit the act. So, yeah, I was very successful and I never really lost that. I never really lost my success. But my mental health got to an all-time low. And you know, I didn't feel purpose in my life. So
despite having all of that success, despite having 500 employees, so many businesses and everything else, you just didn't feel like you had purpose.
Right. Well, I mean, in the military, there's a saying that they're going to tear you down to build you back up.
Right.
And that starts from day one of basic training. I mean, that is the purpose of the military, to turn you into a cool bred killer per se. But when you're transitioning into the civilian world, you're basically building you're doing that all over again. It's reverse psychology. So when that happens, and you're going back to what you once were, there's going to be roadblocks and there's going to be steps that you take, that you don't feel like your succession has anything to do with how successful you are, if that makes any sense. So, I mean, you could be the most successful business owner in the entire world and you're not thinking about that. You're thinking about the other things that you have failed at your everyday struggle is the things that you have no control over.
Right. So talk us through the events of the day. So you left the restaurant and then you went home and what was going through your head?
Sure. I mean, it was just like any other day. I was on a business trip, visiting one of my restaurants in Texas. And you know, I could see myself not really in the mindset that I always am. I'm a perky individual, you know, very in the moment when it comes to I have a strong passion for what I do. So I had one of my chefs actually ask me, is everything okay? You know, you don't seem like yourself. And this is a chef that I see, you know, once every 3 months when I'm on visits. So obviously they knew something was wrong. I had a red eye flight back to Columbus. And when I got back to Columbus, I decided like, that I was going to take the steps to end my life. It was a brief moment thing where I went from 0 to 60. Being that I am in the restaurant industry and have access to, I mean, the stereotype is correct. There are a lot of drugs in the restaurant business. I have access to all sorts of different things. So I decided that cocaine was going to be my choice of how I ended my life. So I had, you know, purchased an 8-ball of cocaine, went home with full intention of ending my life. I did all of the cocaine that I had in 45 minutes. And you know, I don't remember falling asleep, but I know it was quick. And I woke up, you know, 16 hours later, 6 PM, the next day. And I kind of sat up and shook my head not because I was, you know, angry at myself for attempting it, but because it didn't succeed. And I mean, that was the biggest thing for me, was that I wanted to do it so bad that I was mad that it didn't go through.
So as you're sitting, you're and Doc, feel free to chime in with any of your insights on how does somebody get to that point psychologically? I mean, Rob went through it and he lived it, but from a psychologist's point of view, how does somebody get to that point?
That's a complicated question. You know, every person has their own set of maybe triggers that will get it, but I think that there's a couple things to be mindful of, just things that I'm thinking about. You know, when it comes to men are usually more likely to choose a lethal means to do it, usually a weapon of some sort, more likely to compete. That's something definitely to keep in mind. I think what's usually at the root of suicide ideation, whether it leads to attempt or not, is pain. And you have to think about it in context of what pain feels like. So we can all think about physical pain. You break your arm, you get a paper cut, you know what pain feels like. But psychological pain is something that is hard for people to measure. Generally, if there's one thing for you to remember about it, is that pain has gotten too much generally for this person. Just listening to his story and just making some hypotheses, what I'm hearing is that he had that grief going on, and it's not hard for us to have loss. You combine that with transition, that's another loss. And then there's also the loss of meaning, but then there's the guilt that goes with your friends that you've lost and then missing them in general, which is a psychological pain that's just getting bigger. There's different levels to the psychological pain. And then we have a desire to go back. But the reality is whenever we experience pain, no matter what it is, you don't go back. You go to a new place. I guess when you see these days, able to be fully functional, that doesn't mean he's not feeling depressed. Depression looks a lot different for different people. Sometimes it looks like loss of appetite or gain of appetite, loss of sleep or gain of sleep. But sometimes it looks like anger. And it might not, you might not be around a person long enough to see how angry they are, or that anger might be turned in so much that you don't see it at all.
Right, right. And Rob, for you, and I think for veterans in general, like what separates us in our suicidal ideations from our civilian counterparts is the subtle signs that we give off, right? Because we're trained not to go and ask for help, right? And I think, and I'll call it like I see it, the Army does a piss poor job, the military in general does a piss poor job of making it okay to seek mental health, right? We pay lip service to it. We talk about it all the time. It's in safety briefings and the mandatory 350-1 bullshit nobody wants to go to. But what happens when somebody actually goes and seeks mental health? They go from hero to zero in no time. If you have a suicidal ideation, what's the first thing that everybody's going to do? You're going to play that game of cover your ass, right? So we put these guys on suicide watch. We rip them from their families. We stick them in 3-alpha for days on end. And then when they come back, man, they're not welcomed with open arms. You know what I mean? They're just not. So there's that stigma that comes along with it. So Rob, you were posting some things on Facebook that were kind of subtle. And like one of the great things about being a veteran is we have people that know us really well. And you had people reaching out to you, right?
Yes, I did. And I think that was my cry for help. Looking back on it and being fully mentally, you know, at my high right now, I knew that I needed the help. But going to what you said previously, the military does a very piss poor job of promoting getting help. I mean, you're trained to walk into a psych clinic in the military and lie about right. what you're feeling just to get cleared for, you know, military education. And I think that was part of the reason why I was so hesitant to reach out to anyone in particular. I did have, you know, people, you know, seeing my posts. I was posting, you know, just random suicide memes and GIFs. And I had a lot of people, you know, commenting on them and saying, hey, is everything okay? But I think that was my ultimate goal, was just to get people to understand that I wasn't okay, and take the measures to make sure that I did get the help without actually asking for it.
So it's about paying attention, right?
I have a very good friend of mine that I had served with, that, you know, my second attempt, of suicide, came, you know, just the day after my first one. I woke up very angry, that I didn't succeed, and decided that my second attempt was going to be much, you know, less painful and a lot quicker. And I was just going to take a gun to my head. And I had it all planned out, you know, but I have, you know, a very good military close friend of mine that reached out to me at the right moment, and said, look, Rob, I'm going to text you every 15 minutes on the minute and make sure that you're okay. And me not even responding to this individual, he continued to do it and continued to do it. And it allowed me to, you know, gain my conscience enough to say, hey, look, maybe I really don't want to do this. Maybe I do want to get help. And it just so happens that at that point, my family, who lives in Northeast Pennsylvania, my brother had already been on a road trip to Columbus, Ohio, because he had noticed, you know, my posts and everything that were going on. And
so he was coming down there specifically to see you?
Yeah, he was coming down here not really to see me, but to talk me into getting help. So I had called him with a gun loaded, sitting at my side, saying, Derek, I really need help. And it was that moment that my brain kind of snapped and went into, you know, that I really want to kill myself to I really want to get help. You start thinking about all the people that are going to miss you and all the people that really do care about this act that you're going to commit that is courageous in your mind because you're saying, hey, I'm going to take these measures to end my life. So you think you're this big, courageous rock star, but it's really a very cowardly thing to do to take your life at the means of your family and the people that do care about you. So knowing that these people were ultimately there, I had no idea at the time. I just thought I was alone in my thoughts.
Right.
And, you know, I gained a very high perspective of how military brotherhood and how family plays into your decisions to want to commit suicide. So knowing that I have these people and these lifelines, because they really are, these two individuals are lifelines of mine that made up my mind to not do this is just, you know, it's very inspiring to me. And every time, you know, I go into a mental health breakdown, now I look back on, hey, I'm going to fail these people. So
you're going to seek help.
Yeah. I want to add a couple things. First, you know, thanks for sharing. I think it takes courage just to talk about this kind of story. And I think the whole idea of suicide is taboo. It's more taboo than mental health in general. So I think that takes a lot of courage itself. I don't think people really understand courage. I think people assume, obviously what we do as soldiers is courageous, but the other part is sitting with uncomfortable feelings or admitting that we're having uncomfortable feelings. That takes courage too, or even about the times we experience those. A couple of things I wanted to mention. I think that obviously it was great that you had people that were able to recognize what was going on Facebook. And I think in a social media kind of world, there are things that we don't pay attention to, or we don't want to be the person to chime in. And are you okay is one method, but another one, particularly if you have a good enough relationship, is are you thinking about killing yourself? It's a hard question for people to ask. Whenever I have my students think about this question, they get uncomfortable. And I always say, no one say yes, but still just saying the words are hard for people. But having that conversation, people have the myth that if we ask the question, that's going to make the person want to do it, or they're just uncomfortable with the answer they're going to get. But if a person has a chance to release that information, it could do a couple things for that person. So what I imagine you might have been experiencing, Rob, is in your mind, it's like the fog or whatever you're experiencing, we'll call it pain, was causing you to feel like you were in a prison, that you couldn't escape, so you couldn't flex from it. And when someone asks you the question and is there to listen and hear what your pain is, not trying to necessarily just immediately talk you out of it, you got to sit in that prison with the person. What's going on with you? You know, ask the question directly so you know, so that you can have the conversation and sit there with them long enough for the fog of pain to clear up a bit so that the thinking can change a bit, because the biggest factor is usually inflexible thinking at the moment. But it's like a roller coaster. Whatever goes up will come down. If you sit with it long enough and give this person the chance to talk about something they haven't been able to talk about, you might be able to let the fog clear up.
Right. And you know, I didn't really understand at the time that intervening just for a brief second can be that second that someone was going to do it or commit the act per se. Mm-hmm. So just knowing that you have, you know, those people that'll step in and talk you out of it just long enough for you to overcome that fog that you were mm-hmm. talking about, Doc. I look at it as, you know, you're completely overcome by your emotions. Mm-hmm. You're not thinking like the clear-headed individual that you are. Mm-hmm. What people don't really understand about suicide is that it's not the person that's committing suicide. It's really just a blocked mental image of that person that has overcome his emotions and or her emotions, and causing them to basically, you know, it's like having a split personality.
That's really interesting, man. So Rob, you tried twice to commit suicide, right? Your brother-in-law, was it your brother or your brother-in-law?
My brother.
So your brother arrives, convinces you to throw the gun out the window, and they take you. So you were hospitalized for 2 weeks. And what insights did you have, like, post-suicide? Because I'll be honest with you, like what's really hard for me, and I'll be the first one to admit I have anger problems. Anybody that knows me knows I have anger issues, and they've gotten exponentially worse the more time I spend in the military, right? Because in the military, that's not necessarily something that's frowned upon, right? We use things like disciplined initiative, aggression, you know, and I took those traits and took them to new levels a lot of times. So it makes it hard for the people that love us to love us, right? It makes it extremely difficult. Like, all of this is so self, like, we look at ourselves and we feel bad for ourselves, and, you know, I don't care. I have all this anger. This is, we say it all the time. This is just who I am, right? This is just the way I am. Take it or leave it. Because as veterans, we do a piss poor job of being self-aware and evolving into something better, right? This is just who I am. Take it or leave it. And we don't recognize the fact of how hard it makes it on others to love us and to support us, right? Because it's an effort in and of itself, especially like over the course of years. You know what I mean?
So one of the things that I actually didn't quite understand when I was in this mental, you know, state of mind, that the toll that it does take on your family and the toll that it takes on the ones that you love. So my brother comes to Columbus, Ohio, where I live, and he didn't even waste any time being on the phone. He called the police. The police showed up and escorted me down to a local hospital. I spent 2 weeks, you know, inpatient at this hospital. And, you know, my family spent the entire 2 weeks there with me. And they, every time they would come in for visitation hours, I just saw it on their face that they were more or less relieved that I was in a facility that I was being monitored. I was being treated. I was being talked to by professionals. And to see it on their face that they were relieved that I was in. Now, in my mind, I'm saying this sucks. You know, I feel I'm at an all-time low. I'm hospitalized. But to see that they were actually, you know, happy that I was hospitalized and that I wasn't going to go through these thoughts again, it ultimately made me, you know, break down even more, because I knew the toll that I had taken on them. And that didn't improve their mental health. I mean, it just deteriorated all the ones that I love. And just, you know, having to deal with that on a daily basis and knowing that they're 6 hours away or 3 hours away, and there's not too much they can do besides, you know, talk to you. It was very hard for me to accept the fact that I had, you know, caused a very big stress on their lives.
I want to just chime in there. You know, I think some of the things you're expressing are not too uncommon for someone to feel. Rather, they're experiencing, I'll call it a suicidal fog, or they're just experiencing mental health challenges at the time. They're feeling down, they're feeling angry, whatever it is. I think as veterans or people that want to be independent and autonomous, we feel like we don't want to be the weakest chain. We don't want to be a burden. We don't want to basically be like somebody's duffel bag. All those things are things that we think. I remember when I was transitioning out, I tore my ACL, had a blood clot. And even though this is not a mental thing, it's a physical thing. I was having to have help getting up the stairs. I couldn't walk, all this other stuff, right? Which caused me to have to call people and ask people to help me. My family didn't live around, so it was just came down to friends. That was a very humbling experience, something I didn't like doing. And I think it's the same thing with mental health stuff. But of course, if I was on crutches, that would be okay, because, hey, this guy's on crutches. But when you have these mental health circumstances, it doesn't seem like it's okay. And I'm just saying that all that to say, because sometimes this is what blows the fog up even more, because it's like, well, if I tell somebody, then this is what's going to be a burden on them. And I'm not saying that your parents and people around you don't have to make some sacrifices, but it's probably something they're willing to do as opposed to the opposite. So I wanted to speak on that. The other thing is, the reason I think it's hard to talk about suicide is because there's lots of different beliefs about it. You know, we think if someone commits these acts, and I'm not condoning committing these acts, but our thought is that they do it out of cowardice, but they do it out of pain. They do it out of pain. It's really important for people to understand that, because if it's your fellow colleague and not you, or your brother and comrade, your sister and comrade, your sister or brother, you have to understand that they're experiencing pain. The only way that you can help them with that pain is sit with that pain. Now, that means you're going to have to make some sacrifices. We have to trust that people are okay with making sacrifices. We're okay to make sacrifices. We make sacrifices. You know, when we put on that uniform, we decide that we're going to make the ultimate sacrifice. And some of us are broken up because we have friends that have made that the ultimate sacrifice. I do think that responsibility is important, but I think there's a difference between feeling a burden because of how you feel. You have to deal with your feelings. They're your feelings.
Right. And I always refer back to deployment. Because when you're deployed and with your unit out in the middle of nowhere, you know, and you have those brief days where you do get visits from, you know, the company chaplain, or the battalion commander, your mindset as a soldier is just to get that over with as quick and painless as possible, because you don't want that dog and pony show. You just want your mind is on the mission. So I think having that experience and knowing that, whether you're going to be in the suck, the things that you're embracing on a daily basis, the friends that you're losing, the friends that are getting injured and being shipped back to the States, you're learning, your brain is basically teaching itself to, you know, just go with the flow and just to suck it up and drive on. And I always go back to the mind on the mission thing, because you don't really have the ability to stop, think, and really know that you're struggling with your mental health. You don't really notice that until you get home from war. And by then, sometimes, you know, it's too late.
Right. So like when you really look at like, and Rob isn't alone in this, right, Doc? Like when you look at the statistics, 6,000 veterans commit suicide each and every single year, right? So like that statistic is talking about veterans in general. People have this misconception that, you know, that statistic talks about active duty military. Active duty military suicide rates are on the rise, 30% increase in 2018 over 2013 by 30%, right? But 6,000 veterans commit suicide every year. The majority, 58%, are between the ages of 34 and 54. There's a 1.5 times more likelihood that a veteran is going to commit suicide versus a non-vet. And of those veterans that do commit suicide, 2/3 choose a firearm as their primary mode of suicide, right? Rob was a little bit unique in his initial choice of suicide, you know, mechanism. So it's an epidemic across the country and across the veteran community. And when we talk about the military civilian divide, and Rob, you and I talked about this, it's hard to find a mental health professional that specializes in PTSD, right? The VA is ill equipped. When I went to mental health, and I'll raise my hand and I'll say I've been to mental health before. And that's okay. Cause I, like I said, I have some anger issues that I need to hammer out. The clinical psychologist, well, I don't want to say it was a clinical psychologist. I won't do that to you, Doc. But this clown told me that I had anxiety and I was angry because I had arthritis in my knee. And as a man, because I was running slower, because I was no longer able to compete at the level I was used to competing, that somehow was manifesting itself in anger and anxiety. That was the last time I went to go see to mental health. The last time I went to mental health.
First and foremost, I want to comment on the VA. So I completely disagree with PTSD being on a level of a scale. For me, it's just, hey, these veterans want to be heard. These veterans want to get their traumas out in the open and speak to someone. And I think the government does a very, very poor job of, you know, evaluating these veterans and really getting to know where their mindset turned or what exact, you know, event caused them to have these problems. So I would say that the scale that the VA puts you on, I completely disagree with it.
It takes a community to heal a warrior. You know what I mean? So the government is obligated to try and help you as much as they can, you know, pay you, give you disability access, all these other things. But all these people that slap a support the troop bumper sticker on the back of their car and call it patriotism, it takes a community to heal a warrior. It is the obligation of the government to help the veteran. It is only community involvement and interaction that is going to reintegrate that veteran back into society. And I think society as a whole falls very short when it comes to that. You know, we're more, as a society, we get frustrated because civilians are more concerned when the next release of the iPhone is coming out versus the 6,000 veterans that are going to commit suicide this year. You know what I mean? It takes a community to heal a warrior. So for all those people listening to this podcast out there, and you always ask me, how can I get involved? You donate. You volunteer. Find the veteran and help him reintegrate. Look at a resume. Help him find a job. Or just be there to listen. You know what I mean? But Rob, so Doc, you got something?
Well, I just want to give a point of clarification. I'm not speaking for the VA, obviously, right? But I just want to speak to, in terms of PTSD, so that just to understand, I don't want people to be misinformed.
Yeah, please.
From the standpoint of a clinician providing a diagnosis. So there's a whole process for disability, but then there's a process for treatment. And those things are not necessarily the same. From a clinician standpoint, who's not working at the VA, when we're thinking about PTSD, we're thinking about it from what's in the criteria for the DSM, and there's some specific criteria that will meet it. And it doesn't have anything to do necessarily with 30%, 50%, because that disability is based on a lot of different things. But I just want people to understand when we're talking about PTSD, it doesn't necessarily break down just percentage. That's speaking mainly to disability, which could be PTSD, could be a whole bunch of other things.
Right. And then Doc, you correct me if I'm wrong, but I've heard this and I've read this, that PTSD is hard to diagnose because it can look like other issues. It can manifest itself in other underlying mental problems that some people might get confused with PTSD, but might not necessarily be PTSD.
Well, let me just give for the viewer's sake the criteria that we're usually looking for. So we're looking for exposure to some type of actual event, serious death or injury. Actually, it's more common for victims of some type of sexual violence to have PTSD. That would be the first criteria. The second one would be the presence of one or more intrusive symptoms. So an intrusive symptom would be like a thought or a flashback or a dream, something you're trying to avoid for the veteran of an engagement, combat engagement that's coming up, or if it's somebody else that experienced some type of other thing, a hurricane, those type of events keep coming back. So the third one is persistent avoidance. They try to avoid events that will spark it. You know, this is why some veterans may not go where it's fireworks or different places, because they don't know what's going to spark those particular symptoms. And then there's sometimes D, the next criteria is negative alterations in cognition or mood. You know, that can be irritability. It could be persistently blaming themselves, guilt. Those would be those. And then the last one is alterations in arousal or reactivity. So they're hypersensitive, hypervigilant about certain things. You know, a number of veterans don't like their back to be the wall. Some of the things I don't like myself, like if I'm walking down the street, I don't like people walking up behind me. But this would be exaggerated for someone who's experiencing these type of symptoms. It does need to be differentiated from a number of other things. And a good clinician is going to do that. It could be PTSD that is manifest for the veteran's sake from combat, but could also be PTSD that was actually started before combat. I think sometimes we forget that definitely veterans experience some things, but sometimes they experience things before they come in. They just get exasperated when they get in the military.
Right, right. That's real interesting. So, yeah, absolutely. Rob, so like after like you were still successful, and I want to kind of bridge these two stories that we've told of Rob Carpenter, the highly successful entrepreneur that employs 500 people, owns 53 businesses, owns half a gym, you know, does keto dieting, and that's a different podcast that me and you can argue about. But so man, you're still crushing it. What things have you done since November 2018? Because your suicide attempts are relatively recent. What things have you done moving forward that keep you mentally fit? Right, because PTSD doesn't just go away. Your feelings just don't go away. It's Doc, I'm sure you have, you know, some suggestions and beliefs on this. Like, there's got to be a way to cope. You got to manage your day to day. So, like, what do you do? So, I'm going to assume that one of those is purpose, right?
Yeah. So that's the biggest one. You hit the hammer on the nail right there. You find a purpose. You find what you're good at, and you kind of cling on to that. So for me, I'm a very decorated chef. So, you know, I took little things that meant the world to me, such as, you know, funding VFW meals. I started, you know, cooking for the VFW meetings. I'm a very high advocate on PTSD speaking now. So, you know, just bringing these people meals and getting the feedback via email, via text on how important it is to know that someone cares enough about them to, you know, go. And it's more for me than it is for them. And I don't think that they realize that it's actually helping me cope with my anxiety and my PTSD. But, you know, purpose is the biggest thing. Getting back into the swing of your physical health. I don't think that people actually realize how much your physical health ties into your mental health. Feeling healthy, going to the gym regularly, eating a healthy, balanced diet. These are all things that are actually going to, you know, help you mentally. And I'll let Doc get into how these things do it, because I really don't have an answer. But I know that, you know, since November and me really focusing on my physical health and you know, tying into the people that mean the world to me, I've reached out to the community when it comes to guest speaking for, you know, VA, PTSD. I attend regular meetings. I mean, it's helped me tremendously.
So I thought you said something there that was really interesting. What the fact that people come to you for help, right, makes you feel good about yourself and helps you cope. And I think that's something that stems from being in the military, right? Because we constantly, like, when do we feel at our most optimal in the military? When people are coming to us for assistance, right? And what we fail to do when we transition, I think, is still get that. But the fact that people are coming to you and be like, man, you know, you're like, for me, it's been this podcast, right? Because you reached out to me and it gave me a sense of purpose. Like, I'm reaching people, I'm doing something, and reintegrating yourself into that community. And people think just because we transition, we take the uniform off, that means we somehow still, we leave the community behind. And that's not the case, right? It's about integrating yourself back into that community, giving back to that community, and making yourself feel like, hey man, I'm still that staff sergeant, I'm that sergeant first class, I'm still that company commander, I still have, you know, a following. People look to me for guidance, for an example, for advice, and I can still have an impact. Doc.
Yeah, so I have a number of things. I wanted to comment first on the things that he said and give you some of the hows. I'll start with the physical health. The physical health, I think for a soldier, we're set up to do that, you know, barring that you have, you know, you left with some type of physical ailment. But you still might be able to find a way to make that work. And the reason that's so important is because if you're experiencing something like PTSD or anxiety or even depression, then that basically, from a physiological standpoint, it activates your fight or flight system, which is getting activated regularly when you're in a war situation in order for you to respond to the enemy. But the problem is when you get back, your body is ready to react to the enemy, but you maybe don't need to mentally react to the enemy. When you exercise, what you're doing is you're releasing cortisol and adrenaline, and those are the hormones that are responsible for or that get released when you feel stressed. That also is going to affect your neurotransmitters. So basically what neurotransmitters do, they send messages from one neuron to the next neuron to cause you to emote or have motion. When you exercise, you're regularly using those things so that they don't build up, affect different parts of your body. If you maybe have heard of ulcers and different things like that, that these things affect. And the other thing is the mental component of it. So if you think of when you're feeling down, they might suggest that maybe you don't have a serotonin. And you may get a medication for that, which might be needed. But also when you do exercise, you're causing these neurotransmitters to fire, which sends those messages to your brain to move, which is the opposite of depression. So that would be something to keep in mind for your physical stuff and why that matters. In line with that, you probably heard people talk about breathing. I know as soldiers, it's something we practice doing when we're shooting to help us get better aim. but also breathing activates the other part of your fight or flight system. They call it diaphragmic breathing, or breathing from your belly. Because mostly when we get stressed, we breathe from our chest. And if you're breathing from your chest really fast, what you're doing is stopping oxygen from your brain. So this is another way to slow that down. The purpose. Now, why purpose matters? Purpose sounds like a rah-rah, like purpose. Yeah, but purpose is the opposite. The opposite of purpose is hopelessness. And hopelessness is the biggest indicator for suicide ideation. I wanted to take your life, according to Aaron Beck, which is a psychologist who is responsible for cognitive psychology. So how do you refute hopelessness? Purpose. So if you can find a way to reconnect to purpose. Now, I believe that we all have an innate purpose. It's not just necessarily just about you in the military. Maybe some of the qualities that are in you have drawn you to the military. But the other thing is that even if you don't know for sure what your purpose is, this is something that you can create. Just take the initiative to create that fully, and that can help you spark a level of purpose. So here's a couple other things. There's five things that I think would be important. It comes from this model by Martin Seligman, and he studies resilience. He's a psychology that's responsible for positive psychology. So this acronym, you can remember, it's PERMA, or if you want to just remember the first part, PERM, and then add the A, because you think about pressing your uniform. I know they probably don't do that anymore. Used to in my day.
No,
anyways, PERMA, the first part is, okay, so positive emotion. What can you do to cultivate positive emotion? We're not talking about drugging, drinking, or sexing, right? We're talking about finding ways that are actually useful and recognizing that positive emotions can be cultivated in more than those ways. One of the ways to do it is to be ingrained in something that's meaningful and when you have purpose, and that will create the positive emotion. It won't last always, but it's going to be there overall in general. Engagement. So being involved in the thing that you're doing. We live in a world where people multitask, do a whole bunch of things. Really, when you're sitting with a person, be with that person. When you are having a conversation, be in that conversation. When you're putting something in your car together, put that together. When you're in the gym, be there with every rep. Be engaged in that moment. That's going to help your mind from circling and going into anxiety, because basically you're giving your mind a goal. When your mind has a goal, it doesn't have to be anxious. Relationships, that's probably a no-brainer. Work on your relationships. After you get out of the military, you're going to have to create new relationships. It's not always easy. I can speak from living here in West Virginia. When you get to a place, come to a new place, you have to build new relationships. It's not always easy. It's going to require you to take some risks, but it's something that you can do. Meaning and accomplishment, those two things go together. You create meaning. And if you are having a hard time with accomplishment, go back on the accomplishments you've created or you've done in the past and look at those until you get new accomplishments. The last thing I wanted to add was we were talking about how helping others. So there's research that supports the idea that gratitude or contributing yourself to others can actually combat depression. There is research that supports that idea. And that also comes from Martin Seligman.
You know, it's very interesting to me to hear some of those pointers, Doc. And the reason being is because when I originally started therapy for my suicide attempts, one of the biggest things that the doc wanted to talk to me about was my relationships. He wanted to basically, you know, factor in every part of why, you know, my mental health declined. And we really touched a lot on, you know, the relationships that I had prior to the military, the relationships that I had in the military, and the relationships that I had after the military. And one of the most important relationships that I have after the military is that of my 2-year-old son. So we drilled that and how to have successful, healthy relationships with these people. And you know, it at the time it was very, very difficult for me to accept this part of the conversation, because in my mind I'm there for one reason, and that's why did this happen to me. But you know, there's so much more that intertwines in with mental health that the average person doesn't realize.
Right.
There's so many factors that can stimulate your brain and cause you to go into these episodes that you might not be aware of. And that's very interesting that they pointed out those topics. So thank you for that.
Yeah,
no problem. So two things. And I think it's important to note that everybody is going to be different. And Doc Chapman, I'm sure you agree, like what's going to help somebody cope with PTSD, depression, whether you're a civilian or a veteran, is going to be in some instances, unique to every single individual. For Rob, it's his 2-year-old son, right? Universally, I think it's human nature that we all want to be able to say that we have purpose, right? Everybody wants to be accomplished. So I think those are universal, but those things, like, people get it confused, like, you know, success. And you hear about from all these gurus all the time, and I am by no means any guru or influencer. Like, I get in the gym at 5 o'clock every morning, and that's where I start my day, and that's where I clear my mind. And so what happens? People hear this, like, okay, this guy goes to the gym at 5 in the morning. I'm going to do that too. I hate waking up early, and I hate the gym. Well, maybe that's not the thing that's going to drive you to have a clearer mind or really benefit you. But it's important to identify whatever that is, and it's going to be unique to every individual. Am I right?
Yeah, and I want to add two things on there, right? Like, purpose is something that I've always thought was important. I won't say always, but I think it really became important to me when I transitioned out of the military, because it was a rough transition for me, and I just felt like I shouldn't have had to go through what I went through. But this idea of purpose becomes really important, and I think what I've learned throughout the years is I do believe that we're all created with our own gifts. I think what happens is that we spend our time, let's just say we're all parts of a human body. We spend our time with our eyes. We spend our time looking at the hands and being very jealous that we're not hands. Like, oh, I wish I could be hands, because then I could draw, I could manipulate things, I could hold a beer, all these different things. But your eyes, man, if you would just get focused on the vision and providing the vision for the rest of the body, then not only would you feel better, but we would all feel better, because you would be doing what you'd be designed to do. So I think we're all created with something. And in addition to that, though, if you find it hard, there's reasons why we find it hard. There's too much noise, too much chatter in this world. You know, if you think about great athletes, what they say is they have to take away the noise. You got to take away the noise to figure out who you are, right? Now, you're a veteran. You've learned a lot of things in the military, but underneath all that is you. Who are you? You got to take some time to figure that out. And if you're having a real hard time, start creating yourself. Who do you want to be?
Right.
Start doing actions, you'll become that.
Right. That's really good advice that we don't – even though we have to take the uniform off, we don't necessarily have to leave it behind. It can always be a part of who we are and the person that we build moving forward. You know what I mean? So I want to touch just on some veterans programs here. We're going to wrap it up. So if you've listened to this podcast and you know a veteran, or you are a veteran that thinks that they're suffering from PTSD, depression, or you just need somebody to talk to, by all means, you can reach out to myself. You can find me at www.michaelanthonyblanco.com. You can send me a note there. But the Veteran Crisis Hotline is 1-800-273-8255. Press option 1. You can also text for assistance. So you can text 838-255-5. It doesn't have to necessarily be that, you know, you're suffering from suicidal ideation, or maybe you just need somebody to talk to. Things are going poorly. You just don't know, like Doc said, you know, you're trying to find yourself, trying to find a new purpose. Talk to somebody. We as veterans are just programmed not to seek help. And it's crazy and counterintuitive when you think about when you were in the service, you always sought help. You didn't know how to use an M4. You didn't know how to shoot. You didn't know how to pack a ruck. You didn't know how to go into the field. You didn't know any of these things. But there are people there that taught you, that helped you. And those people aren't gone. That community still exists. I know for myself, sometimes I prefer to chat online. So you can go to veteranscrisisline.net/chat if you prefer chatting with somebody online about whatever you got going on. There's also websites like www.maketheconnection.net, where you see stories of success, transition, relating to PTSD, relationship, and they also offer a mentorship program. And then stopsoldiersuicide.org, which is a program that offers mental health counseling, housing assistance, emergency funding for if you're going through financial problems, alternative therapy. They do retreats for veterans that are suffering from PTSD, and veterans just in general, give you an opportunity to go back and connect with that community that you know is so important to all of us. They also offer education, and then also Suicide Prevention Lifeline for veterans, right? So suicidepreventionlifeline.org/help-yourself/veterans. Look, like, Dr. Google can help you solve a lot of problems, man. So if you're having problems, pick up the phone, call somebody you haven't talked to in 5 years. My wife gets furious with me that I leave my phone on ring all night long. I leave it on ring all night long because there are guys like Rob Carpenter out there that may one day, 2 years from now, call me and need me. You know, we always train for the firefight. So anybody that's been deployed the last couple of years, you know that the days of going door to door in a street fight are over. Now you're training for that 10, 20 seconds that might happen one or two times over the course of a deployment, and you need to be equally ready. So be there for each other. And I'll leave you guys with this. It's important for everybody to remember that it takes a community to heal a warrior, right? So if you're a veteran, know that the veteran community is still here. You haven't left the tribe. You might not wear the uniform every day. You might be rocking the DD214 body. That's okay, man. You know, it's fine. Those people that you served with 8 years ago that you haven't talked to in almost 10 years, I promise they are still there for you. All of us are there for you. So I really appreciate Rob. What a tremendous story, man. I wish you the best on your success now and moving forward as you continue to cope with PTSD and set the example for the people that are watching you, man, because the whole veteran community is watching guys like you. And I'll share one more thing for myself. I wake up every day blessed because I realize I have to live a life for the guys that aren't here anymore, right? And I think that's something that the veterans community needs to remember. If you're suffering from PTSD, you're having suicidal ideations, just remember, man, there are dudes and dudettes that did not come home. And as veterans that survived the forever wars or whatever war, it is incumbent upon us to lead a life that is successful and accomplished because we're living our lives for the friends that are no longer here. So Rob, I'm going to ask you just real quick, give three pieces of advice to somebody that's transitioning out of the military.
Sure. And I really do appreciate your end game, Mike. You know, I'm going to go completely into a vulnerable state right here and say, you know, advice number one, stay true to yourself. You're no better than the man to your left or your right. And you need to realize that regardless of the training that the military provided, you need to find your purpose and what's going to make yourself happy in the long run. Advice number two, you know, never judge anybody. I think as a society, and not even as a veteran, we're so quick to judge, you know, someone, whether it be someone at the grocery store or whether it be, you know, anybody. Just try to stay humble and kind. In the words of Tim McGraw, always stay humble and kind. And advice number three, live your life to make those that didn't come home proud. Mike really made a point to say that. And that's a topic that's very near and dear to my heart because I have many friends that didn't come home. And I always to this day will strive to make them proud. So thank you so much, Mike, for having me on this podcast. My goal when I reached out to Mike was to have my voice heard and just, you know, to have my, and as hard as it has been for me to share, I really do hope that it is beneficial for, you know, the next person that has to endure the things that I have.
Doc, any closing comments?
Yeah. Well, I have, before I get to my comments, I have two books that I think might be useful for anyone who decides they want to check them out. There's one, it's called The Suicidal Mind. It's by Edwin Swidman, and he's a thalontologist, somebody who studies death. Might be interesting if you really want to know more about those things I was talking about, pain and those things that exist. That'd be a book for you to check out. Another one is a real quick book. It's 30-Minute Therapy for Anxiety. It's by Matthew McKay. And it's a good kind of book that you can look at if you have some anxiety, or someone in your life does. It's pretty easy to read and give you some useful tools. I would say my three pieces of advice. The first one would be use your voice. I think that one of the things that I hope is ingrained in you as a soldier is that we stand for other people, but we also stand up for ourselves. And one of the biggest tools we have is our voice. It's not just our might and our muscle, it's our voice. So use your voice. And I happen to have had an experience recently where I lost my voice function for a little while, and it can be very frustrating. So you want to enjoy your privileges while you have them. Then I would say the next one is for you to know your value. Know your value. Like, you have value as a veteran, you have value as a person. I happen to believe every person brings value. but you bring a different type of value. And you have to know that stepping into the door, it's going to make a difference with how you step in the door and what you do when you get there. And then I'll say the last one is learn how to integrate your pain into your new experience. You can't go back. There's no going back to where you were before. I wish that, you know, sometimes we wish we could go back and undo things. All you can do is grow through the pain. So you got to go through the pain to grow through the pain.
That's great advice. Thank you guys so much. Two closing comments from me. I'd like to dedicate this this podcast to Jason Swindle, Bryant Luxmore, and Paul Kazupe, and to all those veterans that lost the fight when they got home. All right. Thank you for listening to the War Room Podcast. We had Rob Carpenter, entrepreneur and chef, and Dr. Nathaniel Chapman, clinical psychologist, consultant, and assistant professor at Marshall University. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it. Special shout out to Thomas Massey, who helped me research all the statistics and data on veteran suicide. Tom, I couldn't have done this without you. And especially thank you to the MAGS group for all your continued support. Thank you guys. I hope you listen next week.
You've just been debriefed in the War Room with Michael Blanco. If you've enjoyed this week's meeting, make sure you subscribe to us on your favorite podcasting platform. As always, remember, don't be so afraid to lose that you forget how to win.